got me a job down at the local mill. Work dried up, not a mill is ill. I can pay my bills. Repo man is at my door. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working. Now the boat won't float, I don't like it. I'm too proud to be poor. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working. We're not a working.
To the Illinois World Labor Hour. I'm your host, David Johnson, here with co-host Tom Thomas. Co-host Bob Pelesny's at the marathon today. By the way, if you hadn't heard, traffic's a real problem today. It seems like the marathon's everywhere, especially if you're trying to get to downtown Champaign. If you're planning to come downtown Champaign, definitely leave a little early today. Anyway, the views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WFT, its board of directors, associates, station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the Illinois Education Association Teachers Union and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice. Building coalitions amongst workers, unions, and the community, the Illinois Education Association and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice are proud to support WEFT Community Radio in East Central Illinois. This hour of programming is also brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. Finally, the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Well, we have a very special guest here in the show today. His name is Richard Reynolds. He's a member of IBEW. Electricians Union Local 601 here in town, and he's going to be talking a little bit about his involvement in the community, in the union, and other things that might interest a lot of rank-and-file workers out there, especially in the building trades. But anyway, we're going to go to a little bit of workers' independent news, and then we'll be right back with some headlines.
You're listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. As unification efforts for the labor movement continue, the AFL-CIO, Change to Win, and the National Education Association are creating a National Labor Coordinating Committee to act in unison on major issues facing working Americans. A complete unification agreement will be ironed out in the coming months. The new national committee will deal with issues like labor law reform, health care reform, and rebuilding the economy. Steelworkers came out in Granite City, Illinois on Tuesday to oppose plans to use foreign-made steel for proposed pipeline projects. Jesse Russell reports.
Nearly 1,000 people attended the rally on Tuesday, intended to bring attention to plans to use foreign-made steel for pipeline projects in the United States. The rally was held in front of the shuttered United States Steel Corporation plant in the St. Louis suburb, where many of the protesting steelworkers had previously been employed. The stimulus package approved by President Barack Obama in February does contain a Buy American clause, but that clause does not apply to private projects. Specifically, the workers had gathered to protest the so-called Keystone Pipeline, which will be made with steel shipped in from India. The project is estimated to be $5.2 billion and will span the states of Missouri, Oklahoma, Nebraska, Kansas, and both of the Dakotas.
A federal lawsuit against New York City seeks to change the hiring selection and exam process at the city's fire department. John Coons is with the Vulcan Society, a black firefighters organization with NFDNY. He says it's ironic that New York City is one of the most racially diverse cities in the world, while its fire department is not nearly diverse enough.
Yet, its fire department doesn't reflect that in its hiring of firefighters. So this case is really about people's opportunity to work.
The U.S. Justice Department has intervened in the lawsuit filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights, also alleging that the hiring selection and exams process discriminates. Coons hopes the suit can be resolved before it's scheduled for trial in June.
We're looking for justice to be upheld. We're looking forward to this case being dealt with in an expeditious manner. Ultimately, we're talking about future careers here. We're talking about the well-being of the city.
Here is today's economic report. Does beer help the economy? According to a new study commissioned by the Beer Institute and the National Beer Wholesalers Association, it certainly does. 1.9 million jobs are created by beer sales, and the industry contributes $198 billion annually to the economy. The study suggests 1 million jobs are created within the industry, while the beer industry supports 888,000 retail positions.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org. You've been listening
to WIN. Okay, we're back, and we've got a few news stories. I guess we'll start with Tom today.
Okay. For millions of jobless people dependent on unemployment benefits to get through harsh economic times, the wait for help may be getting shorter. According to Richard Hobby, a spokesman for the National Association of State Workforce Agencies, federal funds are beginning to ease the jams, which included computer system crashes and seriously overwhelmed telephone lines at state employment offices. These problems began easing up when the $500 million from the economic stimulus package President Obama signed in February began flowing in state coffers in mid-March. This aid is separate from the stimulus package's $7 billion for enhanced unemployment benefits, which some Republican governors, including those of South Carolina, Louisiana, Texas, Alaska, and Mississippi, have rejected because they say it would lead to higher business taxes when the federal funds are used up. These administrative funds, by the way, are meant to improve claims processing and to help the unemployed to actually find work. The nation's unemployment rate hit 8.5% in March, the highest it's been in a quarter century. Of the 13.2 million people out of work, 5.5 million are receiving state jobless benefits, and 1.5 million are getting extended benefits from the federal government. In the week ending March, some 28,669,000 people had filed new claims for unemployment compensation. The city was Chicago. 5,000 teachers took to the streets and brought traffic to a standstill. They carried signs with slogans such as, "Public schools are not a luxury, they are a public necessity." With the city's budget being gutted, Chicago teachers, like teachers across the country, called for federal aid to the schools, particularly those that, even in better economic times, had struggled to pay for their basic necessities. They wanted to keep their jobs, they wanted to keep their schools open, and they wanted all kids to have a fair and equal shot at an education. The year this happened was 1934. Those teachers looking for a bailout to keep their jobs won their struggle, and our public schools survived the Great Depression. However, those teachers who were demanding that the basic inequities of school financing be fixed lost their jobs. Three quarters of a century later, school funding in most states is still heavily dependent on local property taxes, which is an inequitable funding formula that shortchanges the neediest of children. The billions of federal stimulus dollars for education will soften the blow, but class sizes will still increase, teachers will still lose their jobs, and inequality will be amplified. Yet, as was the case during the Great Depression, the funding crisis also presents an opportunity to fix the school system. And this time, under our present administration, that might be politically feasible. And finally, in an update of a story brought to you on the Illinois World Labor Hour last month, the worldwide economic slowdown is having an unexpected positive impact in the struggle against global warming. According to government records, the emissions of carbon dioxide are falling significantly. From the Americas to Europe to China, the global economic crisis has caused offices to close and factories to cut back, which means less use of fossil fuels such as coal to make energy. Fossil fuel burning, which creates carbon dioxide, is the primary human contribution to global warming. According to a spokesman for Point Carbon, an energy research company, a recession-driven drop in emissions is good for the environment, but in the long run, that's not how we want to reduce emissions. As carbon dioxide builds in the atmosphere, it traps heat and warms the earth much more than necessary and results in melting glaciers, rising sea levels, and much fiercer droughts. The lower emissions are also caused partly by milder weather, which, of course, means less energy is needed for cooling and heating, and by policies that promote energy efficiency. However, experts still agree that economic problems are playing a major role in the phenomenon. The emission decreases are very unusual and in some cases completely unprecedented.
Well, Tom, I guess there's a silver lining to every cloud.
Yeah, it looks like.
I got another update here. On Monday, the United Electrical Radio and Machine Workers, the UE Union, announced the National Labor Relations Board is charging the owners of Republic Windows and Doors with violating federal labor law. 250 Republic workers conducted a six-day sit-in in last December when the plant was abruptly closed and the workers' vacation and severance pay and health benefits were illegally denied. The sit-in, which generated international solidarity, enabled the workers to win all of their demands, even though the plant closed. The NLRB has issued a decision that agrees with the union's allegations. They include Republic illegally created an alter ego company in Red Oak, Iowa, in order to avoid its collective bargaining obligations with the union. Republic illegally shut down operations in Chicago and transferred work to Red Oak, Iowa, without any notice or bargaining with the union. And Republic illegally failed to provide information for bargaining or process grievances as required under the collective bargaining agreement. The Labor Board plans to approach Republic's owners to seek a settlement based on the charges. If a settlement is not reached, the National Labor Relations Board will then go before an administration law judge in order a resolution. All this is too late to change the abuses of our rights by Republic management, said Armando Robles, president of UE Local 1110 in a recent release. We were deliberately denied our rights and protections under the union contract and law. Only the occupation of our factory in December 2008 won justice for the workers, he said. Last month, California-based Sirius Materials bought the Chicago factory, is in the process of reopening. The new owners have reached an agreement with the UE Local 1110 to rehire all former Republic workers at their former rates of pay and allow the union to continue representing them. And Tom, I believe the CEO of Sirius Materials called into the show, a couple weeks ago?
Really?
For an interview. Bob Pelesny was doing the interview and everything.
I remember.
Yeah. And anyway, I wasn't here, but from what I've heard and everything, this is an unusual company, according to the usual corporate trend. friend. We also have, it's happening again, another big corporation, AT&T, is looking out for its executives and big investors at the expense of workers. In contract negotiations with the Communication Workers of America, the company keeps pushing for cuts in quality jobs, healthcare benefits, and standard of living increase. AT&T claims that these cuts are necessary because of the poor economy. They even had the nerve to compare telecom to the auto industry, even though telecom continues to expand and remain profitable. Just last year, AT&T made $12.9 billion in profits, almost a billion more than the previous year. Jobs with Justice is helping to collect 10,000 signatures on a petition of support in the next week to show AT&T that the country is united behind the workers. To sign the petition, you can go to www.unionvoice.org. And a little local story here. Around 20 students who attended the CIA information session held at the Business Instructional Facility in the U of I campus in Champaign-Urbana on Thursday night had to leave 10 minutes after the meeting began due to a protest held by the Campus Anti-War Network, International Socialist Organization, and Iraq Veterans Against the War. The informational meeting was shut down before its proposed end time. They said that it was just policy that they could not hold an information session in light of protest or the press being there, said Harrison Dobe, graduate student who attended the meeting. The eight protesters assembled near the doorway where the meeting was held, holding protest posters reading "Extraordinary Rendition, Is This Another Name for Torture?" and "Save Kenneth Foster." One student wore a Grim Reaper costume while wearing a sign reading "Abu Ghraib," while another dressed in an imitation of a tortured prisoner with a sack tied over his head wearing a sign labeled "Gitmo." Eric Heim, a sophomore in LAS and spokesman for the protest, said that it's in the third year that the group has protested the CIA in this fashion, but the first time the CIA information session has actually been shut down. "We're here because the CIA has no right to recruit on our campus, especially since our slogan is labor and learning," he said. "The CIA is not here for labor or learning. They're here to train people to overthrow governments." So a little bit of congratulations we have to give out to those students.
Absolutely.
That showed up for that event.
I wish I could have been there.
And a little, I think, a related story. A Spanish court has initiated criminal proceedings against six former officials of the Bush administration: John Yoo, Jay Bybee, David Addington, Alberto Gonzalez, William Haynes, and Douglas Feith may face charges in Spain for authorizing torture at Guantanamo Bay. If arrest warrants are issued, Spain and any of the other 24 countries that are parties to the European extradition conventions could arrest these six men when they travel abroad. Does Spain have the authority to prosecute Americans for crimes that didn't take place on Spanish soil? The answer is yes. It's called universal jurisdiction. Universal jurisdiction is a well-established theory that countries, including the United States, have used for many years to investigate and prosecute foreign nationals for crimes that shock the conscience of the global community. It provides a critical legal tool to hold accountable those who commit crimes against the law of nations, including war crimes and crimes against humanity. And it's also in a new film on the Venezuelan Revolution produced by Viva TV in Venezuela. The new documentary on Fretico explores the movement of occupied factories and workers' control in Venezuela, from the Mitsubishi auto plant to the Interville valve plant, from the Gotcha t-shirt factory to the INAF hardware factory. Workers, young and old, male and female, tell their stories and explain why they came to the realization that demanding nationalization under workers' control is the only way forward, with examples explaining how factory and workers' councils function, the role of the communal councils, and the movement of free trade unionism of a new type. This video provides a living, breathing look at the crucial aspect of the Venezuelan revolutionary process. DVD format, 40 minutes, Spanish with English subtitles. The cost is... you can get more information on this at www.handsoffvenezuela.org. Okay, that's Tom Petty, Won't Back Down, and played that song as kind of an opening theme song to, for our guest, Richard Reynolds. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you, David, and thank you for having me.
Sure. And, you know, Richard, I'm going to have him introduce himself, tell a little about who you are and what you, you know, have kind of done in your lifetime here.
Okay. My name's Richard Reynolds. I was born and raised here, born at Carl, and graduated Urbana High School. I'm a member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 601. And I guess before we get too deep into the issues, I probably should say that I'm not speaking on behalf of my union. My thoughts and opinions are my strictly my own.
Well, yeah, you're a rank-and-file member, and you have that right as a private citizen.
Yep, I sure do.
Okay, well, Richard, I hear you're a troublemaker. Well, you know, I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but frankly, you're in good company with us here in the Labor Hour.
Well, you love to make trouble.
Yeah. Well, troublemaker is a label that I will wear with pride. It's sad that our local labor situation has deteriorated to the point where when a union member exercises their right to ask questions or do something as simple as want to follow the contract on the job, you're labeled as a radical and a troublemaker. So if those things make me a radical and a troublemaker, then they're absolutely right, and I will not back down from that.
Okay. Well, you've been pretty involved with the community in the last few years, in particular with the Democratic Party, and you've been kind of involved in a lot of controversial issues, if you will. Why don't you just give us a little information on that?
Sure. I guess maybe I could start out with kind of where my troublemaker label started. I was appointed as a delegate to the AFL-CIO of Champaign County, the Central Labor Committee, and at this past election, I began to question some of our labor leaders on why they had endorsed some political candidates who had made direct attacks at unions. From that point on, I was labeled as a troublemaker. There was an attempt to shut me up. That did not work, so they then just removed me from the committee.
Well, that's too bad that you guys are appointed from 601, because when I was a delegate to the AFL-CIO from the Carpenters, that was one of the few vestiges of democracy we had left was electing the AFL-CIO delegates. And, you know, it gave me a lot of flexibility because I didn't have to answer to my business agent or whoever. And when they criticized me on the floor, you know, and tried to discredit me in front of the members, I just told my case. The members always backed me up, you know. So I think that's an issue of itself. I mean, I think every local who has delegates to the AFL-CIO should be elected. I mean, because otherwise you get in a situation like you where you're actually trying to do something that was for the benefit of rank-and-file members out there, and for some reason you got entangled in some other type of some backdoor politics, if you will.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more, and I think it's sad. You know, unions are supposed to be one of the last great democratic strongholds that we have, yet when a member does something as simple as ask questions, there is an attempt to shut them up, and there is a punishment for that. You know, this, unfortunately, that is where we're at.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like the Godfather's running the union.
Well, I don't know about that, but it's definitely well. Let's just say that there's a lot of certain union leaders that I've seen here locally and nationally, of course, that seem to do things. That they claim were in the best interest of the union, but in reality is actually not doing in the best interest of the members, but actually some kind of something that benefits them personally.
Yes, I agree. And it's not all of our local union leaders. Mm-hmm. I don't want to make it sound like I'm dumping them all into one category.
No.
There are some real good ones.
But there are some real good ones. There are some real bad ones. And unfortunately, the real bad ones around here seem to be the ones that are in positions of power.
And yeah. Lately they've outnumbered the good ones.
Well, it's a constant battle, but the thing is that's what's really sad about this is because here you are, a rank-and-file member. I mean, you go out and you work your 40 hours most every week, and, you know, you've got a home and a family and, you know, outside interests and stuff. And, I mean, you're spending, you know, free time going there trying to do the right thing for yourself and for your brothers and your local and for the whole labor movement, which is also probably another reason why you got in trouble, because you're thinking just beyond your local and thinking of the entire labor movement in general. But, I mean, this is – and then when someone does that, all of a sudden it's like, you know, you pay the price for it. I mean, this is really, really sad because, I mean, labor movement needs more people like you, Richard.
Sure. And I think a lot of this boils down to ego also.
Mm-hmm.
There is a local labor leader who is the self-proclaimed local political expert,
mm-hmm.
who I've been at every county board meeting for the past year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
I go to a lot of city council meetings. I go to a lot of committee meetings. I've never seen this person at any meeting.
Okay.
So unless you believe that they sit at home at night and read meeting minutes, they have no clue as to what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And when I pointed out some things that were this person's position, that they were incorrect, that was kind of where this whole thing started.
Okay.
He did not like being made a fool of, and my intent was not to make a fool of anybody.
Mm-hmm.
It was to point out, hey, here's what's really going on. Here's where the meeting minutes are. Here's where you can get the facts. Let's look at this person's voting record.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not look at campaign promises.
Oh, yeah.
Voting records are ironclad.
Well,
they're right there.
You know, talk's
what
cheap.
They did, not what they say they're going to do.
Yeah, talk's cheap, you know.
Sure.
Look at their track record, and you can tell a lot about where they're really coming from, you know. That's amazing. I mean, here you're trying to do the right thing, and this happens. But do you want to go into some details as far as some things like, first of all, there was a little controversy lately, not too long ago, about the local Democratic Party forming a labor committee. You want to talk a little about that?
Sure. Kind of along the same line, when I started learning, I started going to the county board meetings during all of the nursing home stuff. I was shocked when I saw some of the county board members who had been endorsed by the East Central Illinois Building Trades and the Champaign County AFL-CIO supporting anti-labor agenda items. It blew me away. I always assumed that we were being looked out for when in
mm-hmm.
fact we're not.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I asked a few local labor leaders, why did you endorse this person or that person? And what I found is that they actually did not know that much about the people that they endorsed. I don't think that this is a completely malicious thing. I think that maybe they don't have time to go to the meetings.
Mm-hmm.
But what really bothered me was when I tried to point out things and could back it up with fact, they were truly offended by that. And as I said, I was removed. So anyway, I decided that I wanted to try and do something that would put labor in closer contact with our local politicians.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to have some kind of an informational conduit between local labor leaders and, say, the Democratic Party and what's going on at this city council, that village board, this county board. And I did not really know how I could accomplish that, but I just started attending meetings and taking notes. I met a guy named David Brayfield, who is on the executive committee for the Champaign County Democrats, and he told me about this idea he had for a labor committee.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, kind of the light bulb went on, if you
yeah,
will.
Yeah, yeah.
We started talking, and a few months ago, the executive committee for the Champaign County Democrats approved the idea for a grassroots rank-and-file labor committee. And basically what would happen is representatives from different labor unions, community activists, and just working people in general, you would not have to be a union member, could
mm-hmm.
get together, discuss ideas, and enhance that informational conduit between all parties. This would truly be a thing that I believe could help make Champaign County a better environment for those of us who work for a living.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, there was some resistance from local labor leaders.
Resistance from local labor leaders for having a labor committee. Now, that's quite interesting just on the surface statement. You want to go into that a little bit more?
Yeah, I'll go into that briefly.
Okay.
Basically, there was some threats sent out to the Democratic Party that if you do not, or, you know, if you do this, and do not allow business managers and officers to control this committee, then we're just not going to fund you anymore.
Okay. Kind of like cutting off your nose to spite your face.
And I think that we have gotten beyond that.
Oh, good, good.
Some lines mm-hmm. of communications were opened up.
Mm-hmm.
There was a meeting. There's now an agreement
mm-hmm.
that the grassroots labor committee can go on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think something, you know, though this started out as kind of a test of wills, I guess,
mm-hmm.
I still think something good is going to come out of this. We are still going to be allowed to have our grassroots labor committee. There's
mm-hmm.
also going to be, as I understand it, quarterly or semi-annual meetings between county board members and other local politicians and union leaders.
Okay.
So
union leaders, but not union members?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. But at least there's this committee now with the rank and file, and all working people can participate on. But it sounds like some local labor leaders didn't even want that. I mean, you know, which, I mean, I heard a rumor, though, that when this was kind of going down at one of the Democratic committee meetings, that you had a bunch of rank and file union members come out from all different unions, billing trades, non-billing trades, to back you up. And actually, they spoke a little bit to the Democratic committee to let them know that the leadership of their unions don't always, even in the best of circumstances, they're not always in touch with what the will of the rank and file is.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. That did happen. We had probably 30 or more rank and file working union members come out from all kinds of different unions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, well, it is unfortunate, the local Democratic Party was kind of caught in the middle
mm-hmm.
of something. I think they were as shocked as I was that labor leaders didn't want a labor committee.
Yeah.
They did not want to get into an argument. Mm-hmm. They did not want to alienate anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when we had a showing, a strong showing of labor people, that maybe that open the eyes of a couple people. Okay, this is what we want to do. And,
yeah.
and as I said, we did finally get the idea approved by local labor leaders to move forward with that.
Mm-hmm.
And while we are on that subject, we are trying to find people who would be interested in serving on a labor committee.
Mm-hmm.
I won't get into too much detail on the show. If somebody would like more information about doing something like this, you can contact me directly. My phone number is 217-530-2602. This is not my committee, but I mm-hmm. can certainly...
Okay. Can you state your phone number again, please? Then we'll do it at the end of the show, too.
That's 217-530-2602.
Okay. Well, okay. We're going to take a little musical break here. We'll be right back with Tom's poem of the week. And, of course, we're going to hear some more here from Richard Reynolds.
Save me. But if I work all day on
Okay, we're now to that point in the Labor Hour, the Cultural Corner, with Tom Thomas and his new poem of the week, Where's the Promise?
How do you define depression when some are saying it's not? How do you define liberty while watching society rot? Who remembers the Hoovervilles that sprouted all across our land when America almost died before we workers took a stand? From the bridge in San Francisco to New York's Empire State Building, we working class are pioneers striving to keep our land melding. We give our blood, we give our lives in building all across our land. When our country needs defended, it is we working folk who stand. Yet suddenly there is no work, because the banks don't want to pay 1 cent of their squandered fortunes to put us back to work today. Now Hoovervilles are coming back and growing like the quest for food. Too many of us now live in abject poverty's neighborhood. Where's the promise we were promised as we built this greatest of lands? Is your home your sanctuary, or is it in some banker's hands? Where's the Promise was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on April the 8th, 2009, and was first recited live on April 11th, 2009, here on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. We got some public service announcements here. First of all, the Champaign County Healthcare Consumers is holding its annual dinner on April 17th, and supporters are encouraged to attend if they can. You can find out more information at www.healthcareconsumers.org. And also, Carol Ammons from CU Citizens for Peace and Justice announced an effort by the Urban Justice Group to bring ex-felons and their stories as monologues to the May 2nd Central Illinois Social Forum. People's Potluck at ChampaignUrbana.net. You can find more information. It'll meet this next Saturday at 3 p.m. in the IMC to preview a film of some examples. Speaking of which, the Central Illinois Social Forum will be held Saturday, May 2nd, at the Independent Media Center, the downtown Urbana Post Office building, from basically noon until midnight or 2 a.m., however long it's going to go. There's going to be a lot of workshops conducted. There's going to be groups coming from Chicago and all other places to conduct anti-eviction workshops, and there's going to be people attending from all over Central Illinois, from Danville, Mattoon, Charleston, Effingham, Bloomington, Decatur, and this is all part of an effort to form mutual aid and support networks in our community that we desperately need as the economy gets worse, and also to connect us in various instruments of empowerment. In that regard, Jim Barrett announced the jobs groups will meet Saturday, April 26th at 2 p.m. in Lincoln Square Mall Food Court to discuss employment resources, addressing issues of underserved populations like ex-offenders and the chronically poor, federal money and job creation in light of the shortcomings of the many existing placement programs. That's Saturday, April 26th at 2 p.m. Lincoln Square Mall. And last but not least, check out Labor's View on Urbana Public Television Station, a labor television program that's on every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. Okay, I get back now to Richard Reynolds. Richard, you mentioned earlier, you mentioned about some certain anti-labor things that some local politicians have done in the past. Do you have any examples of that?
Sure. What I was referring to is specifically, I mean, you're going to have anti-labor people on a board of 27 people. But the ones that I was concerned about are ones that were endorsed by the East Central Illinois Building Trade Unions mm-hmm. and the AFL-CIO of Champaign County.
So basically they took money and volunteer time to get elected, and
yes.
And they're not looking out for us.
Absolutely. One example I've got here is I've got the operational audit from 2007 of MPA, where they audited the Champaign County Nursing Home. MPA is the company who is currently running our nursing home. And this is what they told the county for advice. I'm going to paraphrase. I'm not going to change any words.
Okay.
Says that there are clearly labor relations issues at Champaign County. There is a historical reluctance to discipline employees. The union protects repeat offenders to the detriment of the Champaign County Nursing Home. Says that call-offs are high. The union contract is burdensome. There is a group of union employees who are intent on creating dissent and compromising management's ability to deal with problem employees. Oh. I bet those people are making them follow the contract.
Oh, yeah. What a novel concept there. How outrageous, you know.
Bunch of radicals.
Yeah.
Says that whenever we have dealt with this in the past, increased discipline has been the solution, and we may have a challenge for a period of time. We will need additional support to create a better environment. It would not be unrealistic to retain labor counsel for consistent advice to management as it wrestles with this very difficult situation.
Labor counsel, basically they're meaning anti-labor attorney.
Labor attorney, yeah. Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
To anyone with the ability to read and comprehend, I think that you'll all agree that that is anti-union.
Mm-hmm.
They want to bust the union at the nursing home.
Mm-hmm.
So you fast forward to 2008, this very same company is the one who they asked to come in and run our nursing home. Mm-hmm. Candidates who were endorsed by the AFL-CIO and the East Central Illinois Building Trades spearheaded and were the most avid supporters of it, Management Performance Associates.
I mean, it's supposed to be a public nursing home, and from what I understand the history of it, in the past, I mean, we're not going back too many years, that nursing home has been around, I think, since 1905, that it always had been run by the county, and that it was a totally public institution, that they had no, basically they had people that would stay there for years and years and years, everyone from nurses on down to the custodial people. It was one of the great places to work in Champaign County, and that, in fact, the nursing home had a surplus that the county at times had actually borrowed from to meet some of their obligations. Then all of a sudden, you fast forward here in the last 5 years or more, and all of a sudden, the nursing home is in huge budget shortfall. Basically, they're in debt, and they bring in some private, they're talking about privatizing it. Then they bring in a private management company, and I don't know how much they're paying this private management company, but, and the other problem, I heard there's all of a sudden there's been just tremendous turnover as far as people, that people are just leaving left and right, which is indicative of not a very good work environment. And then I hear also that they're not even hiring local nurses, that they bring them in from some nurse temp agency. I mean, what the heck's happened here and what's going on? And, you know.
Yeah. To me, it looks like they're trying to, for some reason, strangle the nursing home.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not real sure. I've heard the very same things. In mm-hmm. fact, the county board was presented an email with 40-some names on it that were past employees of the county nursing home that said, if you get rid of this administrator, we'll all come back.
Oh, really? Wow.
One of the biggest costs that they have and one of the biggest reasons that they have went into financial stress is that there has been a priority to work agency nurses instead of union nurses.
Mm-hmm.
Agency nurses cost, in some cases, more than twice as much. It depends on which agency they get them from. There's been shifts that could be covered by union people who would not be going on overtime, and the current administrator will tell them, no, we have agency people coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Why would someone hire people who are more expensive when they're claiming that they're trying to save the nursing home?
Yeah, that's a very good question.
A little bit of a contradiction there.
Mm-hmm.
Why would they hire people that beat up the residents of the Champaign County Nursing Home? It's this most recent incident I've heard is only one of many that have been happening.
I've heard this. I've heard the very same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And back on the support for anti-labor companies like this, if our local politicians did not want to say they didn't want to be labeled as union sympathizers.
Mm-hmm.
All they had to do is follow the law here.
Mm-hmm.
The management contract with MPA was given out as a no-bid contract, which is, of course, against the law.
Mm-hmm.
This is being paid with taxpayer money.
Mm-hmm.
There were no other bidders.
Mm-hmm.
The recommendation was from people who were endorsed by the AFL-CIO, we accept this contract. We don't need to look at anybody else.
You know, this is outrageous. I mean, but this does fit the pattern of privatization. I mean, everything from Halliburton in Iraq, the Bush administration, now here, you know, locally in Champaign, Urbana, Champaign County. And this always seems to be the typical thing about privatization is that there's always some. It's supposed to be more competitive. It's supposed to be more cost effective, but neither is the case, you know.
Right, right. And like I said, they if they didn't want to oppose this contract in the name of labor, they could have just said, hey, what we're doing is against the law.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Okay, we're going to take a little musical break real quick, and then we're going to be right back with Rich Reynolds. Okay, that was James McMurtry. We can't make it here anymore. And you're listening to the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT, community radio station for East Central Illinois, 90.1 FM, and webcast worldwide at www.weft.org. And for past programs, you can go to our archive at www.radio4all.net. Okay, Richard, we got a few minutes left here, and I want to talk about something that you've been involved in recently, and that is the current proposal in front of the county board to eliminate the Justice and Social Services Committee. You want to talk a little about that?
Sure. There is a brand new proposal in front of the county board that would, as you just said, it would eliminate Justice and Social Services. It would also eliminate the Highways and Transportation Committees. Justice and Social Services oversees things like the jail, the nursing home, the courthouse, among other things. This proposal has been sold to the public through our newspaper as these two committees will be deleted and their duties will be picked up by other remaining committees, when in fact that is not the case. I have the proposal sitting here in front of me, and it says anything with a strike through is language that would be completely deleted. There are things like under the Finance Committee, they are supposed to plan an overall budget in view of department proposal and county needs. That's stricken through. We don't need to do that anymore. They're supposed to convene a public hearing on the preliminary budget in compliance with the law. That's stricken through. Apparently, we don't need to do that anymore either. This thing would eliminate a lot of the oversight that I believe is necessary. We need checks and balances in our local government.
Mm-hmm.
This would do away with a lot of that. This is right in line with the plan that was mentioned in the paper the other night that we need to streamline and deregulate our government so that it can work for the people.
Mm-hmm.
Alan Nudo is the one who said that quote, and there is nothing in the structure of our local or our county government that prevents them from working for the people. It is the structure isn't the problem. It's the people who sit in those seats.
Mm-hmm.
They repeatedly, some of them, we have some really good ones.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not lumping them all into a group. But though it seems that some of the ones with the loudest voice are the ones who repeatedly go against public will and do whatever they want. I think some of these people have forgotten that they're public servants. I've not heard any members of the public saying that they want to change the way our county does business. I've not heard any members of our public stating that they would like to see committees eliminated. That way, all the committee meetings could be in the first week of the month and give the county board members more leisure time. I haven't heard that. Now, what I have heard is a couple of county board members stating that they would like our government downsized. They would like the oversight eliminated, they would like to allow all committee meetings to be held in the first week of the month to give them more leisure time. I'm aware that being a county board member is a huge commitment. It does take up a lot of time, way beyond just the scheduled meetings. It's a huge commitment.
Mm-hmm.
But all of these people were aware of this when they took their position. And if for some reason the demand is more than they are willing or able to handle, then they need to resign. But they should not put selfish personal interests or a lack of commitment in front of the way that the county does business.
Mm-hmm.
And they're marketing this as a way to save money when, in fact, that's not what it's about at all.
That was a good choice of words, marketing. Because the streamlining here sounds like it's not for the benefit